Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-argument episode of SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Spencer Caron. On November 2nd, 2020, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service versus Sierra Club. This case addressed the scope of transparency under the Freedom of Information Act's key deliberate process privilege. More specifically, oral argument addressed whether documents drafted as part of a statutorily required interagency consultation process between the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Marine Fisheries falls under Exemption 5 of FOIA. This exemption grants that records that are interagency or interagency memorandums or letters that would not be available by law to a party other than an agency in litigation with the agency are protected from disclosure. Joining us today to discuss this case's oral arguments are Nancy Marzulla and Damian Schiff. Ms. Marzulla is partner at Missoula Law, and Mr. Schiff is senior attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation.
We are here today to talk about a case that was argued this morning in the Supreme Court, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the EPA. This is a fascinating case with a number of really important issues. And with us here today to talk in detail about the case and its implications is Damian Schiff. He is a senior attorney. I'm sure many of you on the call know Damian. He works at the Pacific Legal Foundation in Sacramento, California. He has decades of experience handling cases and being involved in cases involving complex property rights and environmental issues. Notably, Damian was counsel of record in Sackett versus EPA, a groundbreaking decision in which the Supreme Court upheld the rights of landowners to challenge Clean Water Act compliance orders issued by the EPA. So Damian listened in on the argument today, and before I turn it over to him to give us the inside scoop of what was argued and discussed today, I'll give you just a brief thumbnail sketch of the case. Basically, the case involves a proposed regulation by EPA concerning water intakes for cooling industrial facilities. And because the rulemaking involved the extraction of water from lakes or rivers or streams, EPA consulted with the Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Marine Fisheries Service under Section 7 of the ESA, the Endangered Species Act. And as a result of that consultation, the agency sent back a Jeopardy conclusion with proposed reasonable and prudent alternatives, which EPA then turned around and adopted in a new regulation. Well, the Sierra Club then sent FWS, NMFS, and EPA FOIA requests asking for their documents regarding the Section 7 consultation. The agencies, however, refused to hand over the documents, arguing that they are exempt under FOIA's deliberative process privilege. So, Damian, could you describe for me then describe for us then the ensuing litigation and tell us what issues were before the Supreme Court today.
Thank you very much, Nancy. And before we get into the nuts and bolts of what was argued today, I think it's appropriate to put the case in the context of the deliberative process privilege and where it came from. In a letter written late in his life to Kentucky legislator William Barry, James Madison warned that a popular government without popular information or the means of acquiring it is but a prologue to a farce or a tragedy or perhaps both. Today, the High Court heard oral argument in Sierra Club. As Nancy mentioned, the case is mainly concerned about an exception to the general rule under the Freedom of Information Act that the public has a right to access government documents. But it also raises the larger policy question flagged in Madison's famous missive I just quoted from, of the extent to which keeping citizens in the dark about aspects of official decision-making is conducive to good government and the protection of liberty. Now, this deliberative process privilege allows the government in civil litigation to withhold documents that are pre-decisional and deliberative, that is, documents that antedate a final government ruling and which assisted the government decision maker in reaching a final decision. The main rationale for this privilege rests, as the Supreme Court has put it, on the, quote, obvious realization that officials will not communicate candidly among themselves if each remark is a potential item of discovery and front-page news. Now, the origins of the deliberative process privilege lie partly in the so-called English crown privilege, which exempted from disclosure things like names of informants and military reports. But although the American term deliberative process privilege is of recent vintage, the principle that some executive documents should be exempt from disclosure was employed early on in our country's existence. For example, see President Washington's assertion of privilege in response to congressional investigations about the St. Clair military expedition or the Jay Treaty. But during the 19th century, most of the debates about the privilege's application didn't reach much below the president and his cabinet. Indeed, it wasn't until the mid-20th century that the federal judiciary made the privilege available to the executive branch generally. The seminal decision is not a Supreme Court decision, but a 1958 ruling of the Court of Claims in a case called Kaiser Aluminum and Chemical Corporation versus United States. This was an action for breach of a most favored purchaser contract. And in discovery, the plaintiff, Kaiser, sought a memorandum written by a subordinate staffer of the General Services Administration giving advice to the GSA's liquidator of war assets concerning government policy on the sale of aluminum plants. In holding against disclosure of the memo, the court, per then retired Justice Stanley Reed, ruled that all such executive documents reflecting advice on policy, quote, of the kind that every head of an agency or department must rely upon for aid in determining a course of action or as a summary of an assistant's research, are presumptively privileged from disclosure. Relying in part on English precedent, Justice Reed defended the application of the privilege on the ground that, quote, free and open comments on the advantages and disadvantages of a proposed course of government management would be adversely affected if a civil servant or executive assistant were compelled by publicity to bear the blame for errors or bad judgment properly chargeable to the responsible individual with power to decide and act. Now, unlike Kaiser Aluminum, the dispute in Sierra Club does not arise from a discovery demand in civil litigation, but rather from an action to enforce FOIA. Enacted as part of the APA in 1946, FOIA was overhauled in 1966 because Congress was concerned that the original version of the statute made it too easy for government officials to avoid having to disclose documents. Nevertheless, Congress codified 9 exemptions from the general rule of disclosure. Exemption 5, which is at issue in Sierra Club, authorizes the withholding of interagency or intra-agency memorandums or letters which would not be available by law to a party in litigation with the agency. The exemption has been interpreted by the Supreme Court to incorporate a number of common law privileges, including the deliberative process privilege. Now, the documents at issue in Sierra Club, as Nancy noted earlier, were created as part of a consultation conducted under the Endangered Species Act. Pursuant to that act, federal agencies are required to consult with the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Fisheries Service to determine whether their proposed actions may jeopardize the continued existence of a protected terrestrial or marine species. At the end of this consultation, the services produce what's called a biological opinion, which includes the agency's assessment of the effects of the proposed action and any reasonable and prudent alternatives to the proposal that could avoid harm to the species or its habitat. The services also typically include what's called an incidental take statement with the biological opinion. This statement immunizes federal employees and private parties from liability should harm to protected species inadvertently result through the action's implementation. The dispute in Sierra Club, however, arises from a 2011 EPA proposed regulation under the Clean Water Act, which is, as Nancy noted earlier, regulates water cooling apparatus for large industrial facilities. Because these structures can harm aquatic organisms, including endangered ones, EPA sent its proposal to the services for their review. By late December of 2013, the services had prepared near-final biological opinions, concluding that EPA's proposal would result in jeopardy to protected species. But at the last minute, the services' decision-makers concluded that revisions had to be made before sending those biological opinions over to EPA. Shortly thereafter, EPA decided, based in part on excerpts of the draft opinions that the services had already supplied it, to amend its original proposal. The draft opinions were then set aside, and new biological opinions were written to address EPA's revised regulation. Both the revised opinions, which now reached a no jeopardy conclusion in contrast to the earlier versions, as well as the revised regulation, were formally adopted by the agencies in May of 2014. Shortly thereafter, Sierra Club and others petitioned for review of the EPA rule, and the Second Circuit upheld the rule, while at the same time rejecting the challenger's attempt to obtain the draft biological opinions as part of that litigation, citing the deliberative process privilege. At the same time as this merits litigation was going on, Sierra Club submitted a FOIA request for these draft biological opinions and related documents. When the agencies declined to disclose them, Sierra Club sued. The district court ruled in Sierra Club's favor, and on appeal, a divided panel of the Ninth Circuit affirmed in part, ruling 2-1 that the services had to disclose the draft biological opinions and a few other documents. The panel majority reasoned that the original draft biological opinions, although they were never formally issued, were nevertheless the agency's, quote, final word on EPA's initial proposed rule, and thus were not pre-decisional or deliberative as applied to that initial proposal. As the majority explained, the documents, quote, do not contain line edits, marginal comments, or other written material that expose any internal agency discussion about the jeopardy finding, nor do they contain any insertions or writings reflecting input from lower-level employees. The government then successfully convinced the Supreme Court to grant cert, and in the Supreme Court party's briefing, one will see that the dispute largely turns on the legal status as well as the practical effects of these draft biological opinions. Sierra Club contends that the opinions clearly represented the service's last word with respect to the then current EPA proposal's effect on protected species and their habitat, and that the opinions certainly had appreciable practical effects on EPA, given EPA's subsequent decision to amend its proposed regulation once it got wind of where the services were going with their biological opinions. But the government counters that the draft opinions were never signed or formally approved by the services decision makers. They were never sent in toto to EPA, and they were never made public. Moreover, because they were never finalized, no legal significance ever attached to them. Hence, in the government's view, the documents remained pre-decisional and deliberative. Now, today's oral argument, in my view, reveals that the court
Damien, could I interrupt you for just
a second? Go right ahead. I'm sorry.
No. What was the issue the Supreme Court certified for review, or issue or issues?
I don't actually have the question presented right in front of me, but the principal issue that the court is addressing, I suppose it really is the single issue, is the scope of the deliberative process privilege in the as codified in the Freedom of Information Act. And if we'll just hold on for one moment, actually, I'll call up to get the exact text, whether Exemption 5, by incorporating the deliberative process privilege, protects against compelled disclosure of a federal agency's draft documents that were prepared as part of an ESA consultation. and that concerned a proposed agency action that was later modified in the consultation process. So it's a good point to raise, Nancy, that built into the question presented is this issue of how draft is a draft. And this is a good segue to the oral argument, because this is, I think, really the heart of the dispute between the parties and focused upon which the Supreme Court focused its attention. As I was saying, the court, in my view, based upon my listening to today's oral argument, is, although sympathetic with the government, is also, I think, concerned with the breadth of the rule that the government has offered to justify a win. As Justice Kavanaugh observed in a preface to one of his questions, the court doesn't want to create a FOIA loophole of allowing government officials to stamp draft, quote unquote, on all documents and ipso facto make them then exempt from disclosure. But I think the court was also concerned about how the government's rather broad rule of what's considered exempt from disclosure would apply in the Endangered Species Act in particular. And this is in part because of an amicus brief that was submitted by a coalition of environmental groups in support of Sierra Club, which highlighted the fact that of the thousands of consultations that have happened under the Endangered Species Act, only a handful have ever resulted in a quote-unquote formal jeopardy opinion being issued. Instead, what actually typically happens is that, as in this case, the services will produce a quote-unquote draft biological opinion. They will share that with the action agency. The action agency then, seeing the handwriting on the wall, not wanting to go forward with their proposal if it's going to mean that the agencies will conclude that it will jeopardize species and effectively put an end to the proposal, will then anticipate that result by then changing their original proposal, have the services analyze the new proposal, and then have the services conclude a no jeopardy opinion. So if, in fact, the government's view of what's disclosable is correct, that means that the public will never be able to obtain draft jeopardy opinions, because, as typically happens, those draft jeopardy opinions are never finalized because the agencies do all that they can to avoid that result. So I think the court is suggesting something of a third way, whereby not just final biological opinions, but also some what you might call formal draft biological opinions would be subject to disclosure, but not materials that precede such a draft opinion. And a good part of the questioning at today's oral argument was trying to figure out, well, where do you draw the line between quote-unquote formal draft biological opinions and truly drafts of drafts, which is how the government characterized the documents at issue in this case.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.